Hello, I'm not Jane Crowther, who's at the Venice Film Festival. I'm Matthew Leyland, reviews editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we're rating horror sequel The Nun 2, comedy threequel My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3, acclaimed rom-dram Past Lives, and action movie-making documentary Once Upon a Time in Uganda. But before we get to that, what have you been watching this week, Neil?
Well, I've been watching a sitcom on Sky Atlantic called The Lovers, which is a romantic comedy set in largely set in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, involving Johnny Flynn as a sort of self-centered political broadcaster who gets sent to report on the situation over there and falls in a rather unusual way with a supermarket worker called Janet. Played by Roisin Gallagher. It's all the usual tropes of the romantic comedy that you expect, but the cast and the setting gives it a bit of different kind of flavour. So I've been enjoying that. And continuing my sort of travels, I've also been watching a film which comes out later this month on digital download called Cats of Malta, which does exactly what it says on the tin.
I've heard tell of this film. I really want to see this. Are you a cat person, first of all, a cat or a dog person or neither?
I would say I'm more of a cat person than I am a dog person. The combination of so many wonderful, furry creatures in this gorgeous setting of Malta makes this the perfect comfort watch, I think.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend that when it comes out on digital download on 25th of September.
And it's got the best Ron Seal title since Women Talking, I think. Yes, I'll be watching that one, certainly.
And also the franchise possibilities are endless.
Well, yeah. Where next? Is there a tease at the end? I mean, do we get a hint of perhaps different content?
I think we're sticking with it. Sticking with Malta for the time being. But yeah, I mean, these cats could go anywhere. These films could run and run.
Cats go exactly where they want to. So I think you're right. Last week, I caught up with The Nun, the original Nun, basically doing my homework ahead of seeing The Nun 2, because I realised I hadn't seen it. My knowledge of the Conjuring universe is quite gappy, so I attempted to go back. So I went and watched that to be fully prepared. I thought it was solid enough. Quite surprised that it's the highest grossing in the Conjuring universe. I mean, I was quite glad I did see it so close to this new one, which obviously we'll get to in a minute. But yeah, I thought it was decent enough scares on a Friday night. Watched it with my cat, funnily enough, whose eyes widened at several moments. So it certainly worked for her. So moving on in a very, very neat link, let's get the conversation going with this.
Sophie, what happened?
I think there's something here. That's not meant to be.
What did you see?
I saw a nun.
Okay, so that's The Nun 2. Neil, is this the best Nun sequel since Sister Act 2?
Well, to set it up, you've set it up already by mentioning The Nun, which came out 2018, was it?
2018, yeah. So a little while ago. There was a little pandemic in the way, which probably delayed it. But yeah, that's quite a gap, isn't it?
The fact that it made 366 million, I think it was, does make it the most successful movie of the Conjuring franchise, the Conjuring universe, whatever we're going to call it. So obviously a sequel is always going to be an inevitability. This picks up the same characters from The Nun, namely a young nun played by Tessa Farmiga and a handyman played by Jonas Blockett, who haven't been introduced in the first movie. They've separated, but it's still in 1950s Europe. And the location has moved from Romania to France because the evil nun demon from the first film, having, we thought, been condemned to an eternal fiery grave of damnation in the first movie, is obviously back. Yeah. She saw the grotes and thought, yeah, I'm having some more of them. Yeah. And has left this trail of dead priests and immolated nuns all the way from Romania to Paris. which has got the Catholic hierarchy intrigued, to say the least. So they find the Sister Irene from the first movie, and they say, you know, you're the nun for the job, to find out what's going on, and which sort of leads on a bit of a detective mission to find out what's going on, and that eventually leads her to this former monastery, which is now a boarding school for girls, where all sorts of weird and not terribly wonderful things are going on. It's all obviously focused around the nun demon, this sort of white-faced ghoul in a wimple who lurches out of nowhere to kind of grab people by the throat and do terrible things to them. But this time she does have help. She's got a little altar boy who uses his incense thing to kind of, is a bit of a sort of bolero. Don't get him incensed, you might say. Good. And there's also a demon in the form of a goat. Yeah. I mean, who are they kidding?
Who are you going to call? Who are you going to call? Come on, say it. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters, yeah. Obviously. Very good. And but really, it's pretty much the same mix of elements as in the first movie, with an element of diminishing returns, leaving it wide open, I'm sure, for yet more nonsensical sequels to come.
The gift that keeps on giving, isn't it, really? Yeah.
What did you make of it?
Yeah, it's very similar to you. Yes, I mean, you reviewed it for the magazine and for Games Radar, and you gave it 2 stars. And yes, I would agree with that. I wanted to like it a lot more because, I enjoyed the first one. I think Thaisa Farmiga, she's a strong lead. I think I like having period horror movies. It makes a nice change from kind of relying on tech and apps and all the other kind of modern accoutrements that you have in films like Scream. So setting it in the past kind of gives it a bit of a charm. But yeah, it is very much diminishing returns. I mean, there's one point where they're discussing how to defeat this evil, and someone says to her, to Sister Irene, well, just do it like you did last time. Just do it. Just do what you did before. And that kind of summed it up, sadly. I thought there's some decent jump scares. There's a scene, a newsstand. I quite enjoyed that. How did you find that scene? That's extended set piece.
You can see it in the trailer, and it involves the pages of this very well-stocked newsstand sort of flickering in the wind to create the image of the nun, like some kind of weird artwork, which did make me think, wow, there's a lot of English language publications in 1950s France on the newsstands. Maybe they might have wanted to deal with that particular detail. The kind of problem I have with The Nun and The Nun 2, and also possibly the Annabelle run of sequels that have come out of this Conjuring universe, is the original Conjuring and the two Conjuring sequels that followed kind of made a deal with the audience. Because they were based on a real couple called Ed and Lorraine Warren, and their cases and their sort of the sort of demonic and spiritual ephemera they accumulated over the decades. As fanciful as this gets, it's rooted in reality. There is some of this really did happen. But with the spin-offs, the Annabelle series and now the Nun series, they're kind of breaking that contract. We're just making it up on the fly, really. None of this happened. Obviously, none of this happened. Mm-hmm. And although we introduce, you know, a few things that exist in the real world, like there's the patron saint of the blind, Saint Lucy, and forms some kind of crucial part of this film's narrative. It's all nonsense. And the gift that keeps giving. And I feel as if you've made this deal and now you're breaking it. My patience with the Conjuring universe is sort of wearing a bit thin as a result. Yeah.
And talking of it as a franchise, I mean, no spoilers, but there's a mid-credit scene. What did you make of that? Did you stay for that, in fact? And what did you make of that?
Yes, the mid-credit sequence. There is a return of two people we know very well from former iterations. But it felt to me like a bit of a sop to Conjuring fans, you know, to remind them, this is part of a wider narrative. And I didn't feel it was particularly effective. In fact, to be honest with you, I'd almost forgotten that by that point that we were in the Conjuring universe.
So it did its job then. It was an effective tease for the continuation.
It does look as if there are plenty more Conjuring films to come. I'm sure there'll be a nun. Maybe the nun can meet Annabelle and go on an adventure together.
Well, yeah,
that'll be the next thing.
Yeah, because you have this kind of shared universe, but there's not. I mean, I haven't seen all the films, but there's not a great deal of crossover. It's quite distinct from the way kind of Marvel works, where characters kind of wander in and out of each other's movies. There's these connections, but they all are quite loose, aren't they? Really. But it seems to work. I mean, in terms of box office, it's continued to flourish. I mean, do you think this one will do well? Do you think this will follow up on the original? And
it's kind of weird that it's opening at the beginning of September. I know the last one did and did perfectly well, but this does feel like a bit of a Halloween movie. And I'm surprised that they're putting it out this early. But, you know, I guess, you know, the box office will be the judge, as it always is. And if it makes sufficient amount, I'm sure. Because I wouldn't imagine these movies are terribly expensive to make. It's all money in the bank, really.
Yeah. We've got a new character in the form of Storm Reid. How does she fit into the narrative?
Well, I was wondering why an American nun was doing in the middle of 1950s France.
Don't question these things.
Exactly. There is a slight reference to some of the tensions that are going on in 1950s America. She makes a reference to the things that her family are going through back home and the troubles that they themselves have faced, continuing a bit of a kind of line in persecution that seems to run through this particular strand. But I felt that she was a rather service to requirements, to be honest with you. I don't think she made that much of an impression. And the same really for Anna Popplewell, who listeners may remember from the Chronicles of Narnia movies. She turns up as a school teacher in this school. That's the element I did like, the school element, full of these sort of mean girls and these 50s era heathers making life really horrible for one of their number. I think, and obviously getting their karmic comeuppance as a consequence. I just thought that was a nice element. And seeing as the first movie had that kind of really spooky deserted monastery, it needed a setting to be as well realized as that was in the original film.
Yeah, I've kind of found them scarier than the actual nun and Valak herself, really. Their presence is so sort of minimal as well, I find. The first one as well, I feel like they haven't really kind of developed her as a monster. She's got this very effective look and can kind of loom out of shots, but I feel like they need to kind of do a bit more with her, really.
Well, she was introduced, Valak, or she or it, was introduced mainly as a painting in The Conjuring 2, this eerie presence from a wall. And that's all she really is. It's an eerie presence. And most of the time, she does seem to stand still and roar a bit and growl, but they haven't really kind of found a thing for her actually to do. But I mean, they know how she can look menacing, but what she actually does isn't terribly menacing.
Yeah, we don't sort of get a sense of like the limit of her powers, really, or what is a kind of a USP apart from lingering and kind of hiding in different spots.
She also seems to have this power to delegate. I mean, at one point, there's three different demons running around. And it's like, wow, you know, nice work if you can get it. But it's like they never establish, even if she can do that, she can really do anything. You know, she could be anybody. She can do anything. Why is she even bothering with what she's doing? Why isn't she just, you know, going over to America and taking over Washington?
All good questions. So are we saying this mother's superior?
I think it's a case of mother inferior, to be honest with you.
All right, so that is The Nun 2, and that's out now in cinemas. So let's now go from Old Fiends to Friends Reunited with this.
What a good story this is. Childhood sweethearts who reconnect 20 years later and realize they were meant for each other. In the story, I would be the evil white American husband standing in the way of destiny.
Shut up. He was just this kid in my head for such a long time. I think I just missed him.
Did he miss you?
Hae-sung!
Wow, 너다.
Okay, so that's Past Lives. Neil, can you give us a present sense of what Past Lives is?
The past was quite perfect for the characters in this film. They were Nora and Hae-sung. They were two school friends who grew up in Seoul in South Korea. And they have this very idyllic childhood. But something's coming. Basically, Nora is going to move with her parents to America. And this beautiful budding friendship is going to be kind of ripped apart, which is very painful for them at the early point in their lives. Years later, when Nora is working as a playwright in America and Hae-sung is still in Korea, they get together over the internet and there's a sense that, oh, maybe this friendship may be reawakened. but it doesn't really go anywhere. They don't get together. In fact, it's another decade or more when they actually do finally reunite, when Hae-sung makes a trip over to New York. And Nora, now a successful dramatist with an American husband, has this very poignant meeting with someone who, you know, as a friend, could have been a boyfriend, could have been her life partner, but she will never know. And that really is the crux of Celine Song's very poignant and very touching film. The past not taken, the possibilities that we didn't explore, the things we'll never know, because life kind of takes us in different directions. And it's really one of the most sort of touching and elegant and sort of quietly moving films I think I've seen this year.
Yeah, so it made its debut at Sundance, didn't it, earlier this year. Would you say it was one of the standouts there?
It was. I think people were already thinking this could be another Coda, possibly, another sort of little movie that could go all the way to awards glory in the following year. We'll see how it does. But it's trailing some you know, incredibly glowing reviews.
Yeah.
And I do think that a lot of them are really, really deserving. I mean, it's really just a three-hander. It's between Nora, her husband, and Hae-sung. A lot of it is in subtitled Korean. You would think that maybe the character that might get the shortest end of the stick is the American husband, but he is fully aware of his role in the proceedings. And there's a fabulous scene, but it goes on for about 10 minutes in the middle of the movie, where he and Nora are just having a conversation before going to bed. And they just sort of pick up all the implications of their roles and their cultures and the way that Hae-sung kind of has reawakened those sort of dormant divisions that were always there, but maybe they weren't really paying any attention to. It's just a really excellently written, beautifully played, and I think Oscar-worthy film.
Mm. For my money, I'm thinking Greta Lee has got a very good chance of being nominated in the leading actress category. Do you think she's got a shot there?
Yeah, I do. And I think John Magaro has a good chance of a supporting actor nomination. Tae Yoo is also very good as the Hae-sung, but his role is a little bit more symbolic, I think, rather than fully fleshed out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He is the catalyst for exposing, you know, Nora's exploration of her own self and her relationships and the choices that she's made. So although he is very good, I think that he's the least fleshed out kind of part of that central triangle. Not that, you know, his performance is any lesser than the other two. Celine Song is written and directed this. It's a really excellent piece of work. I think people have compared to Richard Linklater. There's definite connections to the before Sunset Sunrise series of films in terms of sort of people coming together over a you know, extended period of time. And also, it draws on, I mean, just like Nora, Celine Song was born in Korea. She emigrated to Canada when she was quite young. So it really does draw on her own personal experience to great effect.
And kind of as a love triangle movie, it's quite interesting in that it's not very predictable where it's going to go. I mean, often in these cases, you can kind of tell what the end game is going to be, you know, in a sort of like a Bridget Jones Diary type of way. You kind of know where we're heading. But that's not always the case here, is it, really? It's there's quite a lot of complexity, like a messy complexity to these characters. And I like how it kind of avoided some cliches that you might have expected to happen, some kind of melodramatic developments. So I think as a love triangle movie, it's kind of a cut above in that way.
Yeah, there's a maturity to it and a sort of sensitivity to it that really sort of, like, you know, sets it apart. I don't think you can say that it's a case of, you know, past perfect, but it's almost close.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about it. I mean, it's had critical raves. It's kind of likely to get awards nominations. Do you think it'll have crossover appeal? How do you think it'll play to mainstream audiences?
Well, I think people who seek it out will be glad they did. And I think it's a film with legs. I think it's a film that's going to sort of be around for the next 6 months or so in the awards conversation. So I think people will discover it either in cinemas or when it goes on to other platforms. Just like the film itself is a slow burn, I think it's a film that people will discover and keep discovering. And I hope they do, because I think they'll be happy they did.
Great. Well, that is Past Lives, and that's out now in cinemas. Okay, so now we're going from love triangles to family circles with this.
A lot has happened since my big fat Greek wedding.
Like I never left. Woo!
My father passed away, and his last wish was for us to visit his childhood village and reconnect with our roots. So we're having a reunion.
We're going to Greece.
Oh, yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And by we, I mean the whole family.
Oh. Who wants souvlaki?
Paging souvlaki. Anybody by the name of souvlaki on this flight?
Okay, so that's My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. Neil, is the third time the charm?
We kind of had to go back almost to the early years of this century for when the My Big Fat Greek Wedding story began. In 2002, in fact, was when...
incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, Nia Vardalos wrote and starred in this kind of culture clash story about a Greek-American travel agent who falls with an American teacher. And it was how her large extended Greek family react to the fact that she may be kind of marrying out of the Greek ethnicity. It was a sleeper success. It did very well. I think it was very well marketed, and it went on, I think, to get a couple of Oscar nominations. And it launched Nia Vardalos as a creative force, but it wasn't really one that she was able to capitalize on. That there was a My Big Fat Greek Wedding sitcom which came out in 2000. Yeah, My Big Fat Greek Life. It ran for all of 7 episodes in 2003, and she wanted to make various other films which sort of played on her the persona that she built. One of them was My Life in Ruins, which actually took her to Greece. But eventually there was the second My Big Fat Greek Wedding in 2016, and now we have the third.
I have to admit, I'd completely forgotten there was even a Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. So how does it kind of continue from there? Did that end on a cliffhanger? I mean, was that kind of like the bridge to this epic finale, the second one?
Greek Wedding 2, I'm going to start condensing it just for ease. Greek Wedding 2 did in 2016 was introduce Nia and Ian's teenage daughter, Paris, and it kind of showed how they dealt with the next generation and their problems, as well as bringing in form of the older generation who'd been kind of regulars in the first film. In this film, the third one, one of those regulars has passed on. Nivadas Tula's father has died at the same time as she's received invitation to a reunion in the original Greek village that he came from before coming to America. So this seems like a kind of a moment to reconnect with her roots. So she decides to go to this reunion, bringing most of the clan with her. And they arrive in the a remote mountain region of Greece to find a rather deserted and dilapidated village, not many relatives. And it comes about where they decide to realize the reunion, find some old friends of her father's that will enable her to sort of make peace with his passing. And also, there's a romantic element because Paris is back, having now become a student. And there's an old flame of hers called Aristotle, with whom she has a sort of on-off fling over the course of the film. And of course, at the end, there's another Big Fat Greek Wedding, because you would expect that being that's in the title.
Sadly, I couldn't see this film because I was at the dentist, but hopefully it was better than pulling teeth. I mean, how did you find it, Neil?
To be honest, I'm a little envious, Matthew. I'd kind of rather have been in the chair. I mean, if you like these characters, it's fun to see them back, you know, as well as Tula and Ian. And you have their mother, Maria, played by Lainey Kazan, who isn't in a lot of this movie. Their sort of pushy aunt, Taya, played by Andrea Martin. Their cousins, Nikki and Angelo, played by Giacrides and Joey Fantone of NSYNC fame, and various other kind of colourful kind of hangers-on. But it just feels a bit tired. It feels that rather like The Nun 2, it feels a bit like contractually obligated, or it feels like, you know, they should get together because, you know, there's obviously some money still on the table they can take advantage of. What it did remind me most of all is that they leave Chicago and they go to Greece, it reminded me of, there was a tradition of the third part of the old movies of comedy sequels always going abroad. Going on holiday. I'm thinking, obviously, of Holiday on the Buses being the classic example.
Obviously.
If short of ideas, just take a plane seems to be the solution. Most of it is set in this kind of Greek village, and I thought, well, that looks familiar because I've been there. It was it's a set of a Greek village set that was used in the TV show The Doyles on the island of Corfu. Corfu, and I made and I paid a visit when I went there in Corfu a couple of years ago. I thought, yeah, I think I've done here, been here before.
So there's literally an element of recycling going on here.
Absolutely. And a lot of the old jokes, the old culture clash jokes seem to be kind of coming back. The outsider element is no longer the American teacher Ian. It's a Syrian refugee who is marrying into the family. So that brings in and she is another outsider element that has to be kind of brought into the wider thing. There's also without giving too much away, there's previously unknown relatives that come into the picture. So they come into it. It was very bitty. The scenes are very short. They just lead up to a punchline or a gag and then they move on to the next one. And it always feels a bit haphazard and thrown together.
That, at one point, by Nia Vardalos, isn't it? Is this her directorial debut? Is that correct?
She did direct a sort of low budget film about a decade ago, also starring John Corbett. But it was so low budget, it was kind of like a kind of test dry run, really, for bigger movies to follow, which this is one. For various reasons, and over my previous connections, or I should have more of an affection feeling towards this film.
You have got a bit of a connection going on here, but kind of it didn't work for you.
If you really have an affection for the original film and possibly see yourself in some of the characters, I think you will want to go and see it. But again, it's diminishing returns time. I mean, there's some of the decisions I thought were really quite baffling. At one point, for no apparent reason, characters start walking kind of like the slow-mo Reservoir Dogs kind of thing. That's going on? And I thought the fact that the wedding at the end, it's a candlelit wedding, where I thought, well, considering how many wildfires there have been in the Greek islands right now, that doesn't seem terribly wise. There's one line, I think, which Tula says, "This family is so close, we're stuck together with our own sweat." I thought, that's not an image I want to take with me.
Not really, no. Sweat metaphors, never the best. Okay, well, if you are a fan of the franchise, that's My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3, and you can make a date with that in cinemas right now. Finally, our final movie this week, we're going to head from Greece to Wakaliwood with this.
Yes, take microphone 1, 2. Coming at you live from Africa. Welcome to Uganda.
Okay, action.
This is the home of the best of the best action movies. We call it Wakaliwood.
If we need a gun, we wield it. Anything like a jeep, camera stand, if you don't have one, we make it.
We wanted the white man in the movie, and we didn't know where to get the white man. And he just came in time.
Okay, so that's Once Upon a Time in Uganda. So what's this about, Neil?
Once upon a time in Uganda, there was a former brickmaker called Isaac who decided to pick up a camera and start shooting his own 80s-inspired action epics. And these were the ultimate in cheap and cheerful products, using makeshift thrown-together weapons, crazy sound effects. And as something which I didn't realize was part of the Ugandan film scene, a live commentator on the mic at screenings kind of describing what was going on, like a kind of like circus ringmaster. With very small beginnings and with very few resources, he created this thing which he called Wakaliwood, which was like a homegrown personal movie studio in which he would do these Chuck Norris inspired kind of action knockoffs. In this documentary, one of these movies catches the attention of an American guy called Alan, a film nerd from New York, who decides to go to Uganda, find Isaac, and bring his work to the wider world. And it's about really that kind of relationship between Isaac and Alan. Alan's dream is for Isaac to become a sort of global superstar, his work to kind of go to film festivals and be seen in cinemas all over the world. Whereas Isaac's ambitions are a little bit more kind of realistic. He would like to make a living for his family. If he could even be a success in his own country or even his own town, that would be success enough. So there's a bit of a clash between these two people, which folds out over a number of years. Isaac does get a moment in the sun, which is quite touching to look at. The film itself is obviously, it's a kind of celebration of sort of DIY filmmaking, but it's also a little bit of a critique on the whole kind of white savior narrative, this idea of a guy coming in and thinking that he can be the difference. And really, the people making the art have everything they need and probably don't need outside help.
What did you think they made of that? Because I felt like they kind of skirted around some of those issues. I mean, I very much enjoyed the film, but I felt like it was kind of a little bit incomplete in some ways. It felt like there was more to say about a great number of issues that came up. I mean, how did you find it?
Well, it's interesting because also this week I saw another documentary that came out last week, which may have been discussed on last week's podcast, called Bobi Wine, The People's President. And I felt that these two movies kind of made an interesting double bill, really. One about the sort of like the macro issues affecting the country, and this one about like very micro, about, you know, story about one Uganda citizen sort of struggling from the bottom. Because the film is kind of a sort of a little bit as DIY as some of Isaac's own productions, it could have done more, it could have explored more, but as for what it is, I found it very I found it entertaining, found it quite engaging, and it certainly made me want to see some of Isaac's works for myself and kind of make my own judgment.
And Alan himself becomes a star, doesn't he, at one point? You see him on the camera. What happens there?
Yeah, I mean, any excuse they can find. I mean, Alan just comes along and he thinks he's going to be the producer that's going to obviously bring Isaac's work to the wider world. And really, he just becomes a little bit of a gopher on set, or like, you know, any time that they need a white villain to punish, he becomes that representative. It's interesting in the way it touches on certain kind of issues and about the relationship between Uganda and Africa as a whole, and you know, its former colonizers and the people who have taken advantage of it over the years. So there is this interesting kind of look back to Uganda's, you know, sort of colonial past and its relationship with its largely white overlords, and how that can be reversed by them sort of taking a bit of symbolic revenge on a white guy. So that's quite interesting. But again, it's all pretty superficial and skin deep, and I don't think it really, possibly because of as a result of its fairly limited resources, doesn't go as deep into the background and the context as it could have done.
Yeah, I found the back end of the movie slightly plodding when Alan is kind of struggling a bit and trying to get distribution and funding and trying to bring these films to the wider world. I mean, I'm sure that is, you know, very much part of it, especially on the kind of more smaller independent film scene. But it felt like it was running out of steam a bit as a narrative in that sense. Although I could well see this story being fictionalized at some point, dramatized. I could see, you know, a director like someone like Taika Waititi picking this up and turning it into a full blown comedy. But I guess we'll sort of see how well it does. I mean, do you think this has any kinds of awards chance?
I wouldn't necessarily say. It does feel a little bit thrown together, a little bit ramshackle. Like I say, it kind of has similarity to some of Isaac's own productions in places. But it does show you what life is like, you know, the basically in near poverty, living in a place like Uganda. When you compare it to the Bobi Wine film, it does make your blood boil a bit about the sort of just the way the resources and the wealth and is just basically so kind of kept by the rich, and how everybody else is, you know, left to kind of struggle on, like, you know, with terrible sanitation and unreliable power and the internet going down every 5 minutes, you know, just things that it kind of makes you a little bit kind of angry, really, the inequalities it exposes, even not necessarily without intending to.
Yeah, you do get, it does. It's very valuable in that sense, isn't it? That comes across really well. So that is Once Upon a Time in Uganda, and that's in cinemas right now. And just a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you're all set. And also another reminder that the current issue of Total Film is still on sale, with the Marvels on the cover. And we've also got Challengers, Poor Things, Shane Meadows, and interviews with actors that were conducted before the strike action began. So make sure you snap that up. Okay, so before we go, though, there's time for a listener's question. Are you ready? This is following up from one of the films we discussed. What do you think is the best comedy threequel? threequels are very, there's not that many in general, not that many truly great threequels, but what's the best comedy threequel?
And most of the ones I was coming up with were not terribly great. I mean, you should think of, like, you know, The Hangover Part 3 or Little Fockers. But I'm going to go for one a bit earlier. I think one which did sort of deliver on its promise was The Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult.
You stole my thunder. That kind of says it all, though. We both thought the same one, that this is a very limited field.
I just felt it was one that sort of that took an established character, gave him fun things to do. I mean, this that's the one where Frank Drebin goes to the Oscars and has sort of various accidents with Piers Zadora and Raquel Welch, very gamely pitching in on the lunacy. One, I suppose, we could also mention is maybe Austin Powers in Goldmember.
I mean, the second one was the most successful, but I was not a big fan of that. And yeah, I preferred Goldmember, I have to say. That really kind of delivered on the promise of those characters, but possibly an outlier in that sense.
Another one which I think some people had affection for, again, didn't quite live up to its predecessors, but wasn't too terrible, was Bill and Ted Face the Music.
It's quite sort of poignant in its way, isn't it? As you see them kind of middle-aged. But I felt like they were really overshadowed by their own kids in that one. The two actors who kind of mimic their nuances so perfectly. So I felt like they maybe shoved them out of the spotlight a little.
It's not terribly common for comedy franchises to go on as long as dramatic or action or fantasy franchises. No. I think comedians, they like to go on to other things and create other characters. If they were to make a third Anchorman movie, I would be there first of the queue.
Absolutely, Yeah, surely that's got to happen. I mean, I feel like Will Ferrell's kind of reprised Ron Burgundy in lots of other situations, like at sporting events and random TV appearances. So yeah, I've got high hopes that will happen. And I don't know if it counts, but Back to the Future 3 was another one I thought of. I mean, I know that's more an adventure, action, fantasy, but it is still comedic. But I felt like that was always a satisfying end to the trilogy.
And the other one, which I kind of wish it had been the end of the trilogy, was Toy Story 3. I thought that was as good an ending to a sort of, you know, comedy, fantasy and animated franchise. And I felt a little bit of a disappointed that they wanted to continue to Toy Story 4, which I don't think really added it and may have even sort of detracted from the memories of what I thought was as good a trilogy as ever been put together.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, they're talking about 5, aren't they? I mean, that seems to be on the cards as well, so who knows what there is left in the toy box to explore with that one. Okay, so we're saying Naked Gun 33 and a Third.
I was rewatching the trailer and Frank Drebin is trying to get into the Oscars and he says, like, you know, he's got to get in and there's something terrible that's about to happen. And the doorman says, oh, yeah, and I'm Robert De Niro. And he says, Mr. De Niro, we've got to get in there. Which is a really good sort of summation of the lunacy on offer in that particular prequel.
Oh, I do miss Leslie Nielsen. I'm sure he's making the angels laugh up there. I'm sure he's stumbling about and causing chaos.
Exactly. He's saying, surely you can't be serious. I am serious. And stop calling me Shirley.
Really brilliant. I don't think we can end on a better note than that. So I think it's time to say goodbye. So goodbye, Neil.
Goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next week.